Well, our last speaker of the day, of the evening, and we're very happy to have him with us here, coming down through the rain and hail and whatever else was going on there, is Jim Merkel. Jim Merkel lives in Vermont. He's the founder of Global Living Project and Dartmouth College's Sustainability Coordinator. Originally a military engineer and arms trader, Jim Merkel changed his life at the time of the Exxon Valdez disaster, quitting his job and devoting himself to environmental service and world peace. He downsized his life and 16 years later continues to live simply near the average world income level. Jim founded the Alternative Transportation Task Force in San Luis Obispo, California, and held an elected Sierra Club position while honing urban simple living skills. He lobbied in Washington for wilderness, peace, and Native American rights. In 1994, he received a fellowship to research sustainability in Kerala, India, and walked in the Himalayas. The following year, he founded the Global Living Project and initiated the Global Living Project Summer Institute to discover what a fair share of Earth each individual might be entitled to. With plenty of help from his friends, a permaculture home and demonstration site were designed and built. He instigated a Cycling for a Sustainable Future speaking tour that has logged over 17,000 miles and delivered hundreds of workshops on sustainable living. In 2003, Jim wrote Radical Simplicity, Small Footprints on a Finite Earth. Of this work, Howard Zinn, author of A People's History of the United States, has said, quote, "Jim Merkel has written the most persuasive argument I have seen yet for all of us to radically change the way we live day to day. Radical simplicity joins the evidence of science to a fertile imagination. This is a profoundly important book," unquote. At the top of Jim's cycling career, he earned 3 silver medals in the Empire State Games and raced in the Nationals. Cycling continues to be his primary transportation, both around town and for his adventures to Mexico, across Canada twice, and through Europe and India. His passions include wild edible plants, wilderness, and making homestead improvements from articles found around the dump. Please help me extend a warm welcome to Jim Merkel.
Thank you to John. Let's give him a big round of applause. It's a ton of organizing he's done, and what a great job. And thank you all for sticking around on this really exciting night, huh? The rain is pretty incredible. So just hearing the previous speakers brought me back to my military industrial engineer days. And so I was just thinking about what really got me to make some big, deep changes. And when I think about it, I had some ethical crisis going on in the mid-80s. I was traveling all around Europe, and I had a top-secret security clearance, and I designed some cryptographics and some first-strike capability electronics working with TRW. And so now I was trained in foreign military sales, so I was selling items that were on the munitions list. Like, I didn't sell tanks and machine guns, but those were the other type of items, along with cryptographics, that you can sell with this kind of information. And so I was meeting with arms dealers around Europe, and we were also selling declassified electronics to anyone who would buy it, really. And I started learning firsthand that the stuff I designed was getting sold to Iraq and Iran at the same time in the 80s. We were selling this stuff to the most brutal dictators on earth. And I was a right-wing kid. I was a young Republican and kind of that kind of leaning. And this was violating every ethical cord inside of my body. And I heard Dick Cheney speak in the late 80s when I was in Brussels at a military supermarket, basically, where all these, like, thousands of offense contractors are there selling their stuff. And I heard him give this talk and basically defining, as our previous speaker said, national security as securing our way of life. You know, that was how he openly, overtly defined national security. And so getting resources to keep our high American lifestyle fueled is how we define what we'll go to war for. And that, I just was appalled at that. And so I was beginning to have this ethical crisis. And when the Valdez oil spill hit, I was in an expensive hotel in Stockholm, Sweden, meeting with the Swedish military, and I started to cry when I saw that spill all over Valdez. And I looked in the mirror across this big polished bar, and I said, you know, whenever you point one finger out, three come back at you, right? And I said, this is my fault. I drive to work every day. I've flown 7 intercontinental flights in 1 year. And I said, I have to change, and I didn't know how to do it. And it took me about a year of getting frustrated. But when I got home from that business trip, I started riding my bike to work every single day. And I knew I had to do something. And a year later, I locked myself in my house and I for the weekend. And I said, I'm not leaving here till I figure out how the hell I'm going to quit this bloody job. And so I asked myself the question, how much do I need? Instead of the question, how much can I get? I was doing multi-million dollar business deals for TRW. And so I knew how to run numbers. So I ran numbers for my own life. And I figured at the age of 30 in 1989, if I quit my job and lived on $5,000 a year, I could live for the rest of my life without working. Don't ask me how I came to that, but I did it. And I ran the numbers back and forward. I said, if I take my car off the road, rent 3 of the 4 bedrooms in my house, and plant a vegetable garden, it would work. And 16 years later, I'm still living on the same $5,000 a year, and I'm still haven't touched my capital that I had at the age of 30. So that's what radical simplicity kind of highlights, what I've, like how that happened and the details of it. And to me, I want to talk a little bit about a personal response to peak oil. And it was interesting when I applied for this job at Dartmouth, there was 120 people who applied for it, for this job, a sustainability coordinator. I wasn't looking for work. And the job description landed in my inbox about 10 times, and I didn't even look at it. And then finally I opened it, and friends were saying, you know, you should apply for this. And so I dusted off my old resume writing skills and cleaned it up and presented it. And after about 4 months of interviews and maybe 30 or 40 interviews, I got hired to be their sustainability coordinator. And I thought this title, radical simplicity, would shoot me in the foot, right? How is this institution going to hire some guy who wrote a book stupidly titled Radical Simplicity? But they hired me. And I've been there 4 months. And what I'm noticing is, and I heard this from someone who's on the hiring committee, is each interview that I went through, people who were quite conservative, they watched these people on the committee's minds open up week by week, month by month, of the excitement that could happen of us going to sustainability. How exciting it is of an adventure. And so it's interesting now that I'm there 4 months and I've been working with the institution, like our oil bill just went from $4 million to $7 million in 1 year. When that happened, like, their ears are growing like this big, this fast, like to this whole sustainability thing. We have to do really high performance like we have never seen, and then we have to start doing like one halving, like half your energy. We've already done that at Dartmouth. Now we have to half again, then half again, then half again. Now you can put the solar power on the roof. But until you do those few iterations of halvings, and until we do them at home, solar power is a $30,000, $40,000 adventure. At home, I have a $1,200 solar system that I've been using for 2.5 years in Vermont. It fuels me just well. But you have to first do those few levels of halvings if you want to have a $1,200 solar system on your house that doesn't run out in Vermont. So some of this slideshow will be about that, that my personal journey. So here is, what is the response to this curve that we're seeing? And in 1996, I founded a project called the Global Living Project, and our mission was to live equitably among all humanity, all species, and future generations. And this was a research team with 15 people. You know how they sent the teachers up to the moon on the space shuttle? This was a group of educators sent to British Columbia to see how to live on planet Earth in a way that would be sustainable, considering all life and all species. Okay, next slide. And there was a lot of bumps along the way, and a lot of things were learned, but I'll share some of that tonight. Okay. And the tools, for me, there was three very important tools to help me actually transition. One was your money or your life, and part of it is contained in my book. I cover three tools. The other is ecological footprinting, and the third tool I call learning from nature. And with those three tools, I find we can make really big shifts. And your money or your life is primarily a book about finances. And that's the book that helped me have a plan, a financial plan that can survive the bumps. Like when I first started this, Joe Dominguez, who was a co-author of Your Money or Your Life, I met him in the mid-90s, and he said to me, consciousness grows faster than inflation. He had started living on $5,000 a year in 1970, and when I met him in 1994, he was still living on $5,000 a year. People had asked him, well, how do you do that? Doesn't the cost of living affect you? And he would just say, no, consciousness grows faster than inflation. So now it's 2005, and I could still live on $5,000 a year. And people say, well, how do you do it? I'm like, well, it's easy. And I now believe what Joe Dominguez had told me. Because I've had over, 16 years free to learn so many skills. I have so much time to learn so much. So now I don't have to pay for someone to fix the car. I don't have to pay for someone to do a little work on the house. I can fix things. And you have time to learn how to grow food and do things. And so I really believe what he was saying. And there's many sides to sustainability. And for me, that's the most exciting part, because the thrill of it is what I think is attracting so many young people. Like, they hired me at Dartmouth because the youth who I interviewed with, a whole bunch of students, and they all gave Jimmy the, like, double thumbs up after the interview process. Like, they wanted this guy who rides his bike around and all this, because they know it's thrilling to be sustainable. And the other part of it is, though, we all like to be nurtured and feel the warmth and comfort and the love from each other. So we need that nurture factor in our transition out of this peak oil thing to really pay attention and love each other. Some paint this gloom doom picture of how we'll all be slitting each other's throats. And I don't even go there at all, because the people I've run into in my life, I've met all sorts of people from the Middle East, and I've never met one I didn't like. I've traveled all over on my bicycle, and I don't carry a gun, or I don't carry any protection. I slept in the middle of a city park for 45 days fasting against this 498 years of genocide. When the quincentennial came in 1992, I slept in the middle of San Luis Obispo City in a sleeping bag, and the drunkards would come up to me and kick me at 2 in the morning, and I just talked to them, and nothing happened. So I lost my fear of humanity, and I think that this nurture, that we are very capable of nurturing and loving each other, and that's part of this that makes sustainability very exciting. But the bare bone butt fun of it, that's, to me, is the part that's going to make it sustainable, right? If it's not fun, it's not going to be sustainable, because you can't sustain anything that isn't fun, right? But also, it's really serious business, this business of trying to live as a global citizen. It's easy to say in North America, oh, I'm living sustainable. But what do you really mean? Is that sustainable in the context of 6.4 billion humans? That's a whole other thing. Because what we have is radical disparity, and the previous speaker mentioned this. For example, the poorest billion, well, the richest billion live on $70 a day, and the poorest billion, 25 cents a day. I mean, this is a gap of 250-1, and it is growing. Now, my mom ran a daycare center, and 2,000 children came through there. And the way I grew up with 8 other brothers and sisters, we all had to work. If you don't work, you don't eat. That's how I grew up. And so you work at the daycare center. That's a family business. And so I was around a lot of kids. And if you say to a child, one for you, one for me, one for you, two for me, that's okay. One for you, three for me. And at some point, like one for you, four for me, they're like, wait a minute, not fair. Children have an innate sense of fairness, right? They'll say, busted, it's not fair. Children would never let it get to 250-1. They would never. But us real rational adults who have become so mature can allow this kind of disparity to grow on planet Earth. So we have 800 million people with insufficient caloric intake. So they have mental retardation or stunted growth from lack of calories. And then in North America, we have $30 billion being spent on diets to reduce our caloric intake. So this kind of craziness is why there's a book, Radical Simplicity. But we have 200 species going extinct each day. What would happen if you were on the 100th floor of a building and every day you went to a floor below you and took 200 bricks out of the wall and a floor below you? That could go on for quite some time. This is what we're doing to the web of life. And we're watching the crumbling of the web of life all around us. We are at a place like you and I are right on that steep, steep curve. And the funny part about exponential curves, when they multiply together, they just get steeper. So we have population and consumerism growing at an exponential rate. And those are the two things that are making it so bloody exciting to be alive at this time. No other generation can say they have lived through what we are going to live through. And so to me, this is a story about getting small, but without magic dust. I miss the 60s, okay? I was one of those dazed and confused kids. Okay, so in the beginning, there was this arms dealer, right? I was happy enough to sell cryptographic top secret computers. Oh, yes, but life at the top grew very lonely, and the horrors of war and the cries of the earth disturbed my sleep. I visited the Navajo, resisting, and I witnessed weenies with ties who would stand up and talk for alternative transportation. But when the raging grannies crossed the line at the Nevada test site, and I was there with 5,000 other people, and those grannies, I said, I can't cross the line because I have to go to work tomorrow, you know, and if I get arrested, it's going to be a hassle. And then all these grannies went and got arrested, and oh boy, I was like, give me an affinity group. And I did it, yeah. And what started happening for me is I would see this elder who's doing her civic duty of volunteering. Like, that's what our elders did a decade or two ago, and still there's some around us who do this. They volunteer, and they do all these beautiful things like bringing food to the homeless people, and they're unsung heroes. They're all over our communities, and when I'd hear their stories, I'd start to get tears in my eyes of how beautiful it is. And this, what I started feeling is getting from here to there is so bloody fun. It's so much fun. It's energizing. It's exciting. It's authentic. Like, we get 40,000 TV commercials a year trying to convince us to buy more stuff. You know, you graduate high school, you've seen over 200,000. We're watching, the TV's on for 8 hours a day in the average house. We're sold this, like, lie, you know, this big myth that all you're going to get the sexy girl if you get the car. If you're a woman, you're going to finally be empowered by having this new thing. That's going to make you this awesome person, is by having this thing. And we all know it's not going to happen that way, but we still buy the stuff they're telling us to buy. And it's not authentic. And I think people are dying and hungry for authenticity now. And that's why on the campuses, it's really exciting. I've been touring college campuses by bike now since 1992 or three. And it's been fun because the college students, after we go and do a little program, they don't get up and run out of the room. They come up and they want to talk for like 2 or 3 hours and then go hit the cafe and really philosophize. And they want to know, how can I do something that's different than having, like, sitting behind a computer till you get a pear-shaped body and staring at a screen. And then, you know, you're going to get debt, a car, and plastic baby toys all over the house and sitting in traffic for an hour and a half each way. And, like, that's what they're looking at. And they're like, give me an alternative, please. You know, like, do I have to do this for the rest of my life? This is purgatory. And, you know, and students know, like, what are your kids? Like, if you tell your kids, don't smoke, don't drink, don't lie, don't cheat. Okay, I've been around kids a lot. Like, a three-year-old can lie to you so good. Like, if you didn't see what happened, they'll say, oh, no, she did it. And he'll say, no, she did it. And they'll just be sitting there. And if you didn't see it, you couldn't tell who's telling the truth, right, at 3 years old. How did they learn to lie? We taught them. We lie to ourselves every single day. We lie to ourselves every minute. So our kids, they just see it, and they just mimic what we do. And so if you want to really do something authentic that kids, people are going to pay attention to, You have to do what you have to say, do what you believe is the answer. Gandhi told us this. We have to just live the life that we think is the right life to live, and that's how people are going to learn from what we're doing. Otherwise, they're just going to say you're an imposter. Part of my waking up, in some sense, was going to India, and a lot. How many here have traveled to the Southern Hemisphere? Yeah, quite a few. Who had, raise your hand if you had a worse culture shock when you returned than going over? Okay, quite a few raised their hand. You get this big culture shock because you see how insane it is what we do here day to day. But it does, when you're in the middle of it, it's like the frog in the hot pot of water. You don't really notice it, how insane it is, but until you come back. So I went to Kerala as part of this research team, and it was a fellowship to learn from them how to live more sustainably. And here they have small families and very high quality of life. It's a population of 30 million people, so that's equivalent to all of Canada, living on an area the size of Vancouver Island. But they have life expectancy close to our longevity in America, high literacy rates, and very, very low infant mortality rate, and less than two child families, and they didn't do it like China. They did it through education and empowerment of women. Ah, oh, what a radical concept that is, letting women decide their fertility level. These are young men in the village that I would hang out with, and I asked them, well, why do you think Kerala is so different than the rest of India? And what they said is, well, one thought about it, he says, well, we like the peaceful, happy life. Then the other one chimed in and says, well, we have the cooperative mind. I looked at my journal book 9 months later, and I read that phrase, cooperative mind, and it jumped off the page. And I thought, here in our own culture in New England, we had the village green, maybe 15, 20 houses surrounding it. And you didn't need a law or a fence, because you knew when you took your share, when your sheep grazed your share of the green, to bring them home. You didn't need anyone. You didn't need a law, because we were in cooperation with all our neighbors. We had the cooperative mind. So when you have this cooperative mind, if all the world's people lived as the people of Kerala, 80% of the earth would be wild right now. 80% of the earth's planetary areas would be wild. Right now we're consuming the bioproductivity of the earth at a rate of 120%. We're in 20% overshoot. Humanity as one species is consuming the planet plus 20% every year. That's why we're seeing desertification, CO2 levels rising, ozone depletion, because we're over-consuming. Just the wealthy billion consume the entire annual production. The poorest 5 billion consume the 20%. So 60% of spending is on healthcare and education in Kerala. You see abundant food. I visited an open prison with 280 murderers, and I got to see them up close, like really close. And I was walking right by all these murderers, and I thought, God, this is exciting. And I'm talking to the guard there in the khakis. He's got no weapon, and there's no fence around the prison. And so my first question to the guard is, I had an interpreter. I says, well, what's the philosophy of the treatment here? He said, well, we better treat them nice. They're all murderers. And in 30 years, they've had one escapee and one repeat offender. Well, when I left Kerala, I knew I had to come back and do something with this fellowship. And I was supposed to bring ideas of sustainability back to North America. And my brain had been sizzled, like you put high voltage on me and just like short-circuited everything. Because everything I had ever learned had been flipped on its head. And so I thought, okay, I've read about people like Edward Abbey and, you know, Gary Snyder and Jack Kerouac who just went to the mountains. So I said, I'm going to walk the Himalayas for 2.5-3 months and hope that a vision just strikes me like, wow, oh, now I know what I need to do when I go home. So that's what I did. And I'm out there walking in the Himalayas. And one of my first passes that I crossed was over 17,000 feet. It was still about 25 foot of snow. And the peaks around me are 24,000 feet, and I ended up getting whited out, so I had to sit in my tent with three others, a Nepali who was trying to walk over the pass and didn't make it. He had sneakers with holes in them and a blue jean jacket. We had him in the tent and two others, and we sat it out, and 7 days we were over the pass, and we were into these villages that are, you know, you can only get there by walking. And here you see it's a Tibetan Buddhist area, and all these piles of rocks you pass as you enter the village, each one engraved with the sacred text of the Buddhist mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. And so you see it in all different presentations. And when the people walk into the village, they count their 108 beads or they spin their prayer wheel on their way into the village. So they only bring peace. And when they go from the village out to the world, they count the beads, but they walk on the opposite side of the stones. They count the 108 beads or they spin their wheel and get their mind relaxed. So when they go out to the world, they only bring peace. So they've lived up here for over 1,000 years without destroying this ecology. And I witnessed a very, very timeless, beautiful quality of life there. And if you see the little village out on the precipice, you can see their ecological footprint just by looking. Now, if you wanted to see my ecological footprint, you'd have to go out to space and look down from space and wait for the Earth to spin. And you'd see the bananas that I eat every now and then from Ecuador. And you see a little patch, and that's my ecological footprint for bananas. Keep spinning, and you'd see the cotton in the middle of the southern or whatever, the Midwest or whatever, wherever it's growing. You'd see, you'd have to look all around the whole planet to see the shirt that's maybe stitched over in China. And you'd finally add up and see the little patches all around the globe to make up my footprint. But here you could see it just from a precipice. I returned home, and my idea that struck me was to start a project in North America where we lived as a global citizen, but in the context of North America. So here's Dr. William Rees, who founded the idea of ecological footprint. He's a department head at the University of British Columbia. You can get a PhD there in ecological footprinting. And it's a systematic method of adding up all the little patches around the earth and say, this is how big of an impact it is for me to live my life day to day. And it's done for 150 nations every year by the UN. And they tally up 250 of the largest consumed commodities at the national level each year and do an import-export analysis so you know national consumption. It's a very robust methodology. And so we formed this project in British Columbia, set in a context where there's still cougar, grizzly bears, and wolverine, and we operated there for 8 years to learn, because what I didn't see in India was healthy biodiversity. So here we said, let's live in a place where there's still wild, no significant species extinction, and learn how to live within the context of a wild ecology. But at the same time, take back what we learned in India. So we measured every single thing we consumed for 6 weeks. And if you want to know if you're sustainable, you first have to know how much earth there is. Okay? So if you subtract the deserts, oceans, and ice caps, you have 28.25 billion acres of bioproductive space. You divide it by the 6.4 billion people, we each get about a 4.6 acre personal planetoid. You don't get a mermaid. But you can use this personal planetoid any way you'd like. If you use the whole thing, there's no room for other species. So here you see in the U.S., you would need 5 Earths if everyone on Earth lived like a North American, because we need 24 acres per person. Now, in Europe, it's about half. Mexico, half again. China and India, or the Global Living Project, is half again. So we were able to get our footprints above India and below China for 5 different research teams. Okay, 5 teams. But that was easy enough because it's during the summer. So then we took it on to do it year round. And one of our big things we learned is, look, facing reality, there's only one Earth. It's finite. Earth is finite. When you hear economic growth on a finite planet, that's the ideology of a cancer cell, as Edward Abbey says, right? Just doesn't work. So there's only so much Earth. If you pull the covers over your head, your feet will be cold. This is... Face the fact there's one Earth, and in our systems, and we can design systems that could be sustainable. What we did during our project to get our footprints down to that 3-acre zone, for one, is we did permaculture. So we grew a lot of our own food. We wildcrafted about a third of our food each day, a third of our salad from the wilds. There's so many edible plants. We made it. This is a bread baking oven like you'd see in Mexico. Whatever we didn't grow or wildcraft, we would buy from a local organic producer and bring it back on bike trailers. And here we are. This is Vicki Robin in the white, and she actually participated in eating roadkill deer barbecued. I've brought home about 5 deer now and butchered them, and I won't eat meat except if it's roadkill. And Sandy is a vegetarian now. She did violate her vegetarianism to try to roadkill deer. She said, I think I can go with that. And she really liked it. Now, a big part of our project, I said, is learning directly from nature. We use these tools of analyzing, quantifying very accurately our consumption on Earth. And we do it both in terms of finances and in terms of footprint. But then also, how do you really learn and get inspired? And how do you know on a deeper level what are the needs of other species? When you get to know, say, your best friends and your family and your children on an intimate level, you know what they need. And you're ready to do anything. Like parents are ready to do anything for their children. And or your siblings, your brothers and sisters, your grandparents, your best friends, you'll do anything for them when they need your help. But now when the other species, if you live in a, like most of us end up spending, if we add up the time we spend in nature, like wild nature at the end of the year, how much time is it really? We may go hiking a little. If we spend, say, 1% of our time in nature by the end of the year, for some of us that may even be a lot, but we won't really understand the needs of the other species. We won't really know it. We could read about it in a book, but it's not going to sink in like your own child sinks in, or your own friend, or your parent, your mother sinks in. So that's why I'm saying you need to spend time. We not need to. I don't like to ever say need, but if we do, we will have more compassion for the other species. And that's what I'm trying to get at here. Because really, what does this mama grizzly bear need? I mean, she's going to have some cubs, and she's going to really care for them. Like a grizzly mom, she really loves her cubs, man. She loves them to death. The more you learn about grizzlies, I lived in their habitat for about 8 years. And I'm not afraid of them. I have an immense respect. But they will do a lot of things to make sure they have a good future. And how do we allow her to have that future that she wants to have? We can do it. I found out it's not that hard. But we have to live different. You can't bring your dogs and your cats. You can't leave your garden unfenced. Put a nice big fence and don't attract them in. And you can live there in the middle of the wild, in the middle of the wilderness, and not be having to kill bears. We didn't have one problem bear. And the people lived on our land before shot two. They moved to a new piece of land and shot two more bears. Why? Because they were problem humans. So part of our experiment in doing this year-round was to build this straw bale house. Cost us just $1,500, including the wood stove, electricity, and running water and phone line. And it was built from most of the materials on the land, straw bales and timbers. And it had an ecological impact 25 times lower than standard production. So if we say, we said earlier that our personal planetoid is 4.6 acres. That's just dividing the Earth by the 6.4 billion. Now, if we say we want to leave 80% of that planetoid wild for the other species, so humanity takes 20, and the 25 million other species get 80% of, say, my personal planetoid, I would have to live on 1 acre, roughly. My firewood, one cord of wood takes 1 acre to grow. Like after 80 years, if you took one cord off of 1 acre, you'd still have the forest intact. So I was burning two cords of wood. My biggest footprint item after I got rid of the car, you know, hardly used the car, was my firewood. So this cabin only burned one cord of wood a year, two of us living in it. So it was a half a cord each, and it was 300 square feet. So we reduced our square footage per person from the North American average by 5 times. You know, we in North America have doubled our square footage per person in the last 20 or 30 years, and we're way above what the world's square footage is. A guy from Africa was visiting, and he came and saw this. He's in a band, a musician, and he's just smiling. And I says, well, what's so funny? He says, oh, just like Africa, seeing the finish. And then I said, well, how many people would live in a house like this in Africa? He said, oh, 4 people. So then all of a sudden I felt like, wow, we had a lot of space. In the basement of that little house was a root cellar, and I call this one of the sustainability wonders of the world, because for 12 years I haven't had a refrigerator plug at all. No refrigerator. How do you do it? Well, you dig a hole in the earth. Very simple. We've done that forever. No other device that I know of can store like 1,000 pounds of vegetables for 6 months, and you can still pull a carrot out in May and crunch on it, and it's great. And I've been doing that now for a bunch of years, and it works fantastic. Now, since I returned from India, I've been washing my clothes by hand. And that's to put myself in solidarity with over a billion, maybe close to 2 billion women who wash clothes around the earth. And we've also experimented with things such as going south without fossil fuels. You ever try that? Just say, hey, it's Mexican night over at my house. Da-da-da-da-da. You know, and just have some fun with it. And part of the work after trying all these experiments was to take it on the road and share it. And so we started this Cycling for Sustainable Future bike tours. And we go in British Columbia over 7 mountain passes till we finally hit the coast of Vancouver, because I lived on the interior. Then we tour up and down all the way to California some years and visit universities. So there we would do workshops on how to do your footprint and things like that and get students fired up. And this last year, I'm still doing bike tours, and we've toured around New England 3 or 4 times now. And this last year, my book came out in Spain, and it's called Simplicidad Radical, and I love that name. And you see it's got a different cover there with the snail. And so I was invited to tour all over Spain and promote the book, and that was a lot of fun. So the tours are still going on, and here you see this scavenging a sustainability coordinator at Dartmouth. This isn't my first week. I got a call from a 77 alum, and she says, God, you wouldn't believe what's happening all over campus. The students are moving out, and the dumpsters are full. Now, I'm a self-proclaimed dumpster diver, man. I don't even hide it. So here I am with my tie and everything, and I'm going down with my bike trailer. And I've got, look at the wicker baskets. Those are my office now, and they're really sweet. They're like brand new. You see in the trailers that clothes rack, because I ride the bike to work every day, so I hang my clothes on this rack. You see the art supplies in there? I found a full ream of paper in the garbage. Like there was a little coffee and shampoo spilled on it, but it was wrapped in the cover still. I just took the cover off, and the whole ream of paper was perfect. The students had thrown it away. It was full of cans, jars of olive oil, not even the seal broken, and it was organic. This was in the trash. So, like, this was my first week at Dartmouth, and it was a lot of fun. And I've got to say, after 4 months, I have to do some things to keep sane, because I was used to living on the land for 16 years. So now I'm every day, not 4 days a week. I wanted 3. I settled on 4 days. But so to keep sane, I still eat these wild plants. And that's one part of it, to bring the wildness into myself. And I find that I need to tend my own fire. And part of that is just to spend some time out and just feel the energy of the night, feel the energy of the stars, feel that warmth of the fire, and just take a deep breath and relax and enjoy and just feel the chill on my back and the warm on my front. And okay, great. And it's a time where, for me, it builds my energy so I can go, say, back into Dartmouth. Or for a lot of us, we're working for peace or we're working for the environment. And I think we need to take care of ourselves or else we're going to really burn out. And I know what that feels like. So this is my little cue to really take care of yourselves. And the other part of this, for me, of getting free of oil is to look at yourself as being a prosumer, not just a consumer. So this house produces energy. And we're in an old homestead that was founded by Laura Waterman, who's written 5 books on a manual typewriter, and we still carry the water from the creek and buckets and all that, making our own medicines. Here's a timber frame poop palace. It's a composting toilet. It's the first one I've ever heard of on the planet Earth. Timber frame, mortise and tenon joinery done by a team. We run workshops on our land each weekend. There's a little brochure over on that table. We do one on medicinal and edible plants, on timber framing, all these different topics. Here's one on gardening for self-reliance. And some of our biggest problems we have, I find, is trying to eat all the food after you grow it. It's just too much sometimes. Last year we grew our own grains, and this year again, so we're eating our own pancakes. Here we thrashed it out on our own floor. So you have blueberry pancakes from your own flour ground by hand. You have blueberries jarred. We have our own honeybees, and we have our own maple syrup that we make. And that, in the middle of the winter, is like, you can't buy that, right? And so this year we even did an Antioch master's class on our land. And here we had them sort out all their stuff and do their footprint on their first day. They don't know what they got themselves into. But it's, you know, after you do your footprint, you need some comic relief. And this team of women were really empowered, because they actually plumbed this hot water solar system up. And they hadn't sweat pipes or or wrapped Teflon tape around plumbing fittings and learned a male from a female. I think they knew that piece, but when they really got to say it out loud, like, I need a nipple, or do you got a male threaded union, you know, or something, they enjoyed that piece of it too, learning those plumbing parts. And then for some of them, it was a time to really define their practice. And there's things you learn, like shit from Shinola and a solar cooker from a spaceship, and it was really fun. And I think the folks were realizing that having sharp tools really helps. And this is me thrashing the winter rye with these little blocks. It didn't work, but it was very much a fun thing. And Wendell Berry talks about taking back these proxies. Like, so the corporation's going to keep us warm, right? That's what we think. But we can meet our needs without fossil fuels, right? The corporations. Yeah, but how will we get around? You know, we wonder. Who will feed us? Huh? How will we stay warm? The myth is if we don't buy into mother culture, we're going to freeze, right? And in Gandhi said this in 1939, you cannot build nonviolence on a factory civilization, but it can be built on self-contained villages. And I think it still applies. And here's a Gary Snyder poem. He says, we need no fossil fuels. Get power within. Grow strong on less. Grasp the tools and move in rhythm side by side. Flash gleams of wit and silent knowledge eye to eye. Sit still like cats or snakes or stones. As whole and holden as the blue-black sky. Gentle as wolves. Tricky as a prince. In our work and in our place, in service of the wilderness, of life, of death, of the mother's breasts. That was a Gary Snyder poem written back in the 70s in the Turtle Island collection. And it's very apropos for today. And I just want to ask, who here has ever fallen in love? Like, anyone here? Okay, I see most of the hands up. Not everyone's fallen in love. No? Okay, yeah, okay. At least once. Now, can you remember the first month, what that was like? Remember that? Did you do some really crazy things? Like, silly, like, you know, stay up all night, like, and then go to work the next day, or try things you never thought you'd try, food you never thought you'd eat, and you started to have dreams together, right? Did any of you ever have dreams with your partner, like the first month, like feel so excited and giddy and like anything is possible? And did it ever feel like sacrifice, you know, to try new things and change your old behaviors? Did it ever feel like sacrifice or like, oh, we're so willing, right? And so what I feel is if we fall in love with the earth like this, the same way, we'll do anything it takes to be sustainable. So thank you so much for listening tonight.
Okay, and Jim will take some questions, and we get this back here at the right spot.
I'm sure somebody knows where the light switches are in here. So I want to see all those faces. I could see some of them during the talk, but now once we get the lights on, I'll see more. Yeah, thanks, John. So if we have any questions, that would be great. And just go on up to the microphone.
Hi.
Hello.
Feels great, but I live in town, and I wondered if I feel like it sounds like community and having a community house or the old-time type of, a community house. To capture the feeling of the fact that we are together and we could put our energy together an awful lot more than we have. I want to live like you've described, and I have changed radically the way I live. from living in Mexico. But I live here, and that isn't changing for a while. So I'm inviting people to join me in trying to connect with people, like, you know, human animals. I like you guys. Thank you, Jim. I really enjoyed
everything. All right.
Everything.
Thanks. Great. And I think if doing this simple living, it can happen anywhere, right? It can happen in the city. I've done it in the city for years. It was really fun. And then I did it in the wilderness. And now I'm doing it in rural Vermont. And each place is different, but I find each place is really rich and rewarding. And so that's great if people do simplicity in the city. Yeah.
I have a question. I was looking for your opinion. I moved here from Wisconsin, and I had a hard time adapting to New England. And it's taken me a long time to try to understand the culture. And I was going to ask you, I finally came up with this theory that I was used to Wisconsin, where it was in the South was agriculture. You know, you're a farmer. I was a forester there. So, and up north, you were dependent on your resources. Everyone's livelihood was connected to the land. So either way, we were all much more cooperative communities. And when I came to New England, I felt that it was more competitive. And I realized, or this is my own theory, okay, you know, that maybe people from New England felt that their survival was dependent on competitiveness versus cooperation. And that's what when I saw that in yours. And I was wondering what region you came from, or a cultural, or is it something you developed? If you could comment on my theory.
Well, I lived for 17 years out in California, so I've got all sorts of theories and opinions. And, you know, my brother says opinions are like our one orifice that we sit on. He says everyone has them and they all smell. So my opinions aren't so great. So it's an interesting thing to try to comment on the differences. But I grew up in New York, and then... And so when my buddies and I would say, well, let's go canoeing in the summer, and we talk about it in the middle of the winter, all seven of us would show up on a certain weekend. And when I moved to California, people were so friendly. They come right up to you and talk to you in the bar and everything. I'm like, God, this is weird. In New York, this would never happen. You just talk to your friends that you already know. If you saw a stranger, you wouldn't talk to them. But then I met all these people, and they're all so friendly. And then we say, hey, let's go do something on 2 weeks from now. And then I call them up the night before. Hey, you ready to go? Like, what do you mean? Oh, where are we going to do it? Oh, I made other plans. So it just felt like it was a different culture out west. And so, you know, it's just interesting in the way people cooperate. And I'm in a little town in New England now, in East Corinth, Vermont. And I was attending a book discussion, and there's all these really old timers there. And I asked them, well, what happened? We were reading Grapes of Wrath. And so I asked this woman who lived through the Depression, what was it like in East Corinth when the Depression hit? She said, we didn't know anything different. Because we all took care of each other before the Depression. We took care of each other during it, and we take care of each other after. And when a young woman in our town just had a baby, they all have a schedule worked out. The postmaster is the kingpin behind all this. This elder woman, Nancy, she knows everything. And there'll be a dinner on that young mother's doorstep every single night. You know, like, this is cooperation, but it's kind of different.
Oh, hi. And hi. Thank you so much for your share. It was full of life and vibrance. I lived a similar journey, and then I went out to the Lakota reservations, and I did a lot of wilderness survival. But my question is, I'm experiencing a lot of trauma from recovering from kind of the high religious political regime that was over my work. I have work about Native people in Hollywood, and they have targeted me. I've been targeted with murder threats, but it's exhausting. And I'm trying to pull back and recover and get out of that whole scenario of these are like political religious people that are trying to almost force me into their realm and to work with them.
Wow. Well, I wish you luck with that one. That doesn't sound fun. Well,
it's not easy.
No. Well, I hope, wish you luck.
I just wanted to know how you felt you recovered from, you were in that realm.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, for me, I when I quit my engineering job, I decided I was going to keep friends with all my old engineer buddies. So we'd still hang out together. And I tried to really do it because my parents are ultra right wingers. Like they, my dad is self-proclaimed right of Rush Limbaugh. And I love him to death. You know, he's just a wonderful man. Like if you're broken down in your car at 2 a.m, he's going to stop. Like this one kid used to pick on my brother and he'd throw apples at him, beat him up all the time, my younger brother, because he's an artist and very, you know, kind of feminine guy. And the kids would beat him up. So one day they thought it was my brother. It was really my mother. And if you want to get in a fight with somebody like my dad, he's a bulldog. He's about 5'8" and he pressed iron every day because he had 4 sons and he knew he could kick all their asses all at once until he's 65, and he still could. So, I mean, you pick on my mom, you're in trouble. So this kid is throwing apples, rotten apples at my mom. He thought it's my younger brother. And my dad sees the same kid a week later hitchhiking, and he picks him up. You know, that's my dad. So it's hard for me. Like, I try to keep in both camps as much as I can and not feel. And so I've never had any death threats or anything, but it's been interesting. So I still can, I can see, I've heard it happen to people. I've had politicians tell me that they were opposing Walmart and they would get death threats. And one guy actually recorded the whole phone conversation. He was a city council member, 28 years old. And that was a very enlightening conversation to hear how they threaten people. Not fun. So I'm sorry to hear that going on for you. Next question.
I don't have a question. I want to say you're an angel.
No.
You have risen my energy level so high with joy. So God bless you.
Thank you.
Well, I have a couple of questions that have to do with the practicalities of all this. 25 years ago, my wife, 3 kids, and I built a house together. And it was enormously exciting. We had quite a lot of help. We hired out some of the work, the heavy concrete work. But I don't know how many nails I pounded in, how many pieces of wood I cut. I was able to use my chainsaw to work out all of the ends on the timbers. It was a post and beam house. And they came through and followed afterwards with hammers and chisels. Now, all this is fine. It was wonderful fun. And if we'd lived in the right kind of community, we could have stayed there. But the overall culture says, no, kids got to get out and go to work. And as it works out, my daughter is in Wisconsin. My son was for 12 years in New York. And the other son was in Portland, Maine. If we were still living in a community like that, I couldn't do it anymore. You know, you could still bicycle to work. But you're probably in your early 50s, maybe late 40s. I don't know.
Oh, look at this guy.
What's that?
No, never mind.
Okay.
Watch it.
That was something like a confession. Okay, 32. No, I was adding up things. I can just barely get on my bike now. And I'm never quite sure whether I'll get off it safely. I've got to sell my motorcycle. I mean, that's terrible. One of these days, I won't even be able to play my tuba anymore. And yet I'm not yet 80, and I'm going to go on for a while. How can a community be put together that will allow all the people in it to use their skills effectively, including the people like me? I can still teach. I can still run musical things. But you've got to have a way in which all of your people in whatever stages of decay they may find themselves in as the decades decades. Oh, I never realized those two words went together so well.
Yeah.
You know, the modeling of these communities has to be really clear so that you don't get people really ticked off at each other because they're old and sitting in a chair.
Yeah. You know, I've been to so many meetings of people trying to put together these communities, and everyone I've been to, they say, we want to have elders in our community. We want a multi-generational community. It's hard to do it, but, I mean, that's what the vision is that I've been hearing. I lived in a community setting out in British Columbia. We never got any elder folks to join us, but we wanted them. And now my sister and I, we thought we would never let my dad go into an old folks' home. But finally, we have to go in and feed him now. He can't even lift a spoon to his mouth. So 3 meals a day we're feeding dad, who is this bulldog guy, you know. And we finally couldn't take care of him, you know. And 50 years ago we would have, you know. And he would have died by now, probably, you know. He tried to kill himself even. He found it was time to go for him, but, you know, we rushed him and saved him. But I think he knew even a few years ago it was his time, you know, and he was just ready to go. But I think what this man is bringing up is so important for us to remember as a community. We've got to try to figure these things out. I don't know the answers, but I think all of us feel in our hearts, like, to see elders, like my grandma, when I watched her sit and watch the TV, and she would say, look at those children, they're so beautiful on the TV. Why isn't she with her grandchildren right now? Right? Why isn't she? Well, out in my friend who I went to Kerala with, Dr. Will Alexander, he's part of a Quaker community out in California. I think it's up just north of the Bay Area. And part of the philosophy, he doesn't ever want an ambulance to come for him. He's about 78, and he doesn't ever want an ambulance. So he's told everyone, don't call the ambulance. But the community of Quakers there, they're helping him out. And he's going to die quietly there at that community. That's what his decision has been. And so he has all this knowledge, wisdom. He's traveled the world, and he's a great storyteller. And anyone who's around him is just loving his wisdom. So his exchange is his wisdom, and the community takes care of him. And I think that's a beautiful model, and I think we should do it all over New England. You know, intergenerational support for each other.
One more question.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Well, he's wanting me to do more. What's wrong? Come on. Do you want to help me build the next little house? No. All right. No, but I took this job at Dartmouth, and I think what compelled me to take it was the Iraq War. When war is going on, I feel just torn apart inside. Like, we've killed 1 million people since 1989. In 1989, Iraq had the highest health care and education in all the Middle East, the best. They had $3,600 a year income. Now they have $500 to $600 a year income. Imagine your whole country being brought from $3,600 a year to $600. Infant mortality rate went from 40 in 1989 under the brutal dictator of Saddam Hussein to 107 under Bush. You imagine 107 children dying out of 1,000 before the age of one? And Condoleezza Rice says she's after the moderate Muslim. How the hell are you going to get the modern Muslim on your side when you have an infant mortality rate higher than India in the 60s? Really? You know, this is a disgrace what we're doing there. And that motivated me to work at Dartmouth. And I can't work on peace really too much because I get too passionate and I fry. And so I'm working on a solution, in a sense, only because I don't have the choice to work for peace, really. I get too crazy inside. And so part of my Dartmouth job is creating alternatives. Now, I met with the chief financial officer, and I showed him a study that was done. If they do their buildings according to LEED certification, bronze, silver, gold, platinum, each time you about have the energy. And then now we're building them right around bronze. That's what we're doing at Dartmouth, and we're all proud of it. I'm like, wait a minute. I showed them the study that in 30 years, it's cheaper to actually build it beyond platinum. It's cheaper to build a living building. I showed them a study done. And 3 days later, he called a meeting of the 12 biggest decision makers at Dartmouth. And we sat in the room, and he asked me to present to them this report. And the room was like 80% behind this new dining hall, which is going to be like a $40 million building, to be like notched up almost to gold platinum level. I attended a meeting to build this new medical center, a $90 million project. They invited me to come. And I said, what if we go for platinum? They said, that's what we want to do. We want this new medical center to be a shiny example of the best ecological building you can build. So this is my latest thing. Is I'm at Dartmouth, and I'm finding, I just called a meeting of the student roundtable. 30 students showed up. This is student leaders. This isn't to get, this is to get the student leaders to sit at the roundtable. I am super excited. I just attended a conference on greening the campus, a national conference, and they are hiring sustainability coordinators coast to coast. And some of the stuff they're doing is making Dartmouth look like they're in the dark ages. They're really pushing the envelope. So Dartmouth had to hire me because their peer institutions are ahead of them. And my job is to make Dartmouth a leader in sustainability. That's what they hired me to do, overtly stated. A leader and embedded into all the campus's activities, everything from academics, if you study business or engineering, you'd come out understanding a finite planet. The buildings would be sustainable, student life, the community, the whole package, research, everything. That's what they hired me, and they said it right in my job description. I've got this mandate that's like so exciting. So I'm really inspired for the future, and I really thank people for coming tonight, and I'll be over here to sign books and talk more. Thanks.
Thank you.